From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Ron Elving on the Week in Politics. Then, Mike Lindell of MyPillow. A Trump ally runs for governor in a state the president has never won. Also, how an Edinburgh critic keeps up with the Fringe Festival. Plus, Willem Dafoe in the new film Late Fame about a rediscovered poet and the dangers of praise.
You know, flattery can ruin you. Flattery can make you believe you are who other people say you are rather than who you are.
And later, Yo-Yo Ma brings musicians together with historians and activists to try to tell America's story. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, August 8, 2026.
For KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Incarceration can put people into the system for years and destabilize their families. This spring, KAXE distributed a survey aimed at reaching Indigenous people who were willing to share their or their family's experiences with the criminal justice system. Jennifer Combo was one of those survey respondents and agreed to share her family's story in a more in-depth interview. Combo is 37 and her partner, Jason Gorno, is 42. Gorno is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. These lands are near Belcourt, North Dakota. Combo is a Turtle Mountain Band descendant. The couple have been through the highs and lows of incarceration and addiction while together and also while separated. Both now live at East Grand Forks with their blended family. As a toddler, Combo's eldest son was diagnosed with a liver disease, which he described as challenging for a young mother while also attending college in Moorhead.
Alcohol, and then I was introduced to meth. I thought that was the answer, to be able to do all the things, go to school and take care of him, and until it wasn't. And it took everything from me eventually.
Shortly after his successful liver transplant at age 10, Combo's son was removed from her custody to live with another relative.
I really had nothing to live for and ended up homeless, living out of my car, and getting my first felony for stealing my mom's checkbook.
Combo says she bounced between sobriety and addiction until she and Gorno were arrested on the same day almost 5 years ago. During the raid in October 2021, law enforcement officers stopped Gorno and found large quantities of narcotics. Officers secured a warrant for their shared residence, which also led to Combo's arrest. Gorno was facing 10 years in prison due to his extensive criminal history.
Yes, so it was pretty wild, but mostly the things I went to jail for was driving without a license, not be able to pass a UA for weed, you know, back then. And some of the harder drugs back then, too. Living on the res, you start drugs early. Back in my era, you did.
Gorno said his childhood was marked by the traumatic death of his father at the age of 8 and a stint in juvenile prison that followed running with a tough crowd. Like many KAXE survey respondents who were impacted by incarceration, Gorno especially experienced challenges securing housing after his early release from prison. After a successful completion of a diversionary boot camp, Gorno said he tried his hardest to maintain the conditions of his parole, but finding housing with his record was challenging. Eventually, Gorno found an apartment that accepted him, but it wasn't a place that felt like home.
The place I took is just like a slum place known for easy renting, so I got in there and put up with it like I was never there, though. I had to settle there. I couldn't live where I wanted to live.
Combo and Gorno say they didn't have strong cultural connections as youth.
Raised in a time in a family, and you just keep going. You just keep going no matter what. And if that means you have to drink or do drugs to keep going, then that is what was done.
She says even though she and Gorno had a rough start with their parenting journey due to their addictions, they aim to do better for their younger children.
We were able to, do what needed to be done through community resources and support and investment, reconnection to cultural identity, and just a desire to make it work and give them what we didn't have and we couldn't give our older children.
Gorno says the greatest joy in his life these days is his children. He works in Crookston as a mechanic. He is nearing the end of his parole.
The numbers were against me, right? I'm supposed to be already getting high at this time and back in jail and going back to prison and not finishing my parole, but I was kind of consciously aware about all these numbers toward me, so I keep it like a low profile life.
Campo graduated early from probation, became a homeowner earlier this year, and has launched a campaign for a Minnesota House seat. She now works to help others navigate similar challenges.
I refused to become a victim to this system again, and I showed up in community. I showed up everywhere outside of my comfort zone to not allow the things that happened to happen again.
Read more in-depth coverage on this story and other parts of the Overrepresented Undercounted series on KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Todd Blanche was confirmed as Attorney General of the United States early today after a contentious and at times uncertain Senate confirmation process. All Democrats as well as two Republican senators voted against confirming President Trump's nominee. NPR's Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
The final vote was 50 to 49. Can't get closer to get confirmed. The biggest hurdles were Republican lawmakers. What convinced them?
They say they got a written commitment that Blanche would not pursue that $1.8 billion compensation fund that Trump wants for people prosecuted under the Biden administration, including the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. But the last holdouts who gave in also expressed more general frustration, saying a vote against Blanche would not rein in Trump, or saying anyone Trump appointed to replace Blanche would be just as bad or worse. So not exactly a champagne moment. There were the two Republicans who voted no, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Blanche is still very much the face of the Epstein files story and other controversies, and all of that will now be front and center through the midterm campaign this fall and for the next 2 years after that.
This week we heard of a temporary deal between Iran and Oman. Iran says the deal allows it to control ships entering the Strait of Hormuz, collect fees, and still block vessels linked to the U.S. and Israel. U.S. has yet to accept or reject the deal. After over 5 months of this conflict, with this as the only deal on the table, does President Trump risk losing credibility even with his supporters?
It's more than a risk at this point. Major polls show nearly two-thirds of Americans say the war should not have been started. And when the numbers get that lopsided, you are reaching that Trump voter base. Trump can call all those polls fake, as he does, and he can say his polls are just great without sharing the data. But against the facts on full display, that's just too much of a stretch, even for many Trump backers. You don't build credibility by straining credulity. So even the Pentagon's top general is now reported to be seeking an off-ramp. The U.S. clearly wants to end this war much more than Iran does, because Iran right now is winning control of the Strait of Hormuz, leaving Trump on the horns of a dilemma. He has few options for escalation, and he can't get anywhere without it. So he threatens escalation and hopes the tiny country of Oman can step in and salvage a good deal negotiating for him.
In Michigan, the progressive candidate Abdu El-Sayed won the Democratic Senate primary by a percentage point over the moderate Haley Stevens. Does this portend a shift in the Democratic Party?
It's not a straightforward case of one off for just this race. And it's not quite a straightforward case of the entire party moving forever. There are clear signals here about the kind of Democrats who vote in primaries. They're moving left, as they have in the past, ready to listen to more radical rhetoric, ready to try more radical policies on taxes and health care. But this Michigan race was also a mismatch in terms of the two candidates, the dynamism. El Sayed is a gifted communicator and clearly the stronger motivator. But he also opens the door to more divisive figures who will alienate elements of the traditional Democratic base, alienating supporters of Israel in particular.
On Thursday, President Trump signed two executive orders to limit eligibility for birthright citizenship. The orders narrow the scope of the people he's targeting, but he signs these orders just a few weeks after the Supreme Court struck down his last attempt to get rid of birthright citizenship. Do you think he'll prevail?
We can't rule it out. The latest assault on birthright citizenship is much more targeted, testing the edges around the court's earlier decisions, looking for exceptions where Trump and company might get a partial win and save face. We also see Trump trying to reverse his losses on other matters just now. He wants to try again to remove Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve Board, looking for a way around the high courts telling him he couldn't do that. He is also looking for the Supreme Court to overrule a lower federal appeals court order that blocked construction of his new ballroom, replacing the east wing of the White House. An addition he calls a military site. And the federal appeals court this week said he could not do this without Congress's say-so. So we'll see if the Supreme Court agrees or sides with Trump and the overarching authority of the executive branch.
Brian Elvin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
President Trump has never won the state of Minnesota, but Mike Lindell of MyPillow fame is running for governor there on a Trump-forward platform and leads some polls. Dana Ferguson from Minnesota Public Radio News saw Mike Lindell at the annual Farm Fest trade show this week where candidates made their pitch.
While other candidates in the barn-like building dressed in jeans and T-shirts, Mike Lindell was in a dark suit and red tie. And he name-dropped his friend in the White House.
I have an advantage over everyone up here. I can call up and work with the President of the United States.
Lindell is a longtime Trump ally who joined the president in denying the results of the 2020 election, getting sued for defamation by voting machine companies, one case settled, one ongoing. Trump lost Minnesota in his presidential runs. His administration has targeted the state for Medicaid cuts and led the immigration enforcement surge that left two observers dead. So when he gave his powerful endorsement to Lindell for governor, it was a problem for the party establishment that had endorsed someone else at its May convention.
It's really not shocking to see that he has bucked the party and their endorsement process by choosing someone that he's got a close personal relationship with.
That's Republican political strategist Priya Samsundar.
I think it's more surprising that he did not choose a candidate who had an ability to win statewide.
The state party chair has raised questions about Lindell's residency. A former party leader resurfaced allegations Lindell physically abused a former girlfriend. Lindell's long denied that and says his residency is in order. He says the party leaders want him to lose.
It's a coordinated attack. It started when I got the president's endorsement.
Mary Jo Kukochka came to pick up a Lindell yard sign from the campaign's booth.
Thank you.
She says she's backing Lindell because he has Trump's seal of approval. And
he's an honest individual, and he's not your typical politician promising you all kinds of stuff and not delivering. He's not a polished spokesperson.
Back in the pavilion, Lindell's competitors talked about change, like Kendall Qualls, who did get the party convention's endorsement.
When I was on active duty as an artillery officer, when the conventional forces couldn't get it done, we brought in the special forces. We brought in something different. This is why we need different leadership in the state today.
Candidate Lisa Daymuth touts her work leading a tied Minnesota House of Representatives as its speaker.
Absolutely everything that we passed over the last 2 years had to be bipartisan. We have proven that we can do that here in Minnesota, and as your next governor, my proof is that I can lead this state.
Also on stage was the Republicans' likely Democratic opponent in the fall, Senator Amy Klobuchar.
We do not need a governor who is a rubber stamp of Donald Trump. We need a governor who is going to put you first, who's going to put Minnesota first.
She chastised the Republican candidates for all failing to oppose Trump on tariffs, immigration policies, and the war in Iran. For NPR News, I'm Dana Ferguson in Morgan, Minnesota.
This is Europe's summer of heat. All 27 cities Italy's health ministry monitors, including Rome, Naples, Venice, and Bologna, are on red alert this week. People have been advised to avoid sunlight, sweet carbonated drinks, coffee, and alcohol. Imagine trying to avoid sunlight, fizz, wine, and espresso in Italy. The World Meteorological Organization says this was the hottest June ever recorded in Western Europe, and now the heat has returned. Great cities like London, Paris, Madrid, Florence, and Rome that draw tourists to museums, markets, theaters, and restaurants are considered especially open and exposed. Those beautiful cities are sculpted out of brick and stone and connected by monumental asphalt avenues, which absorb the heat and hold on to it at night. Officials in France are just beginning to get hold of the toll of the June heat wave. They count at least 5,700 excess deaths during the swelter that climbed to 111 degrees Fahrenheit in the early part of the summer. Many of those who died were elderly, often alone, in a stifling house or apartment. Germany recorded nearly 100 drownings during the worst of the June heat, many of them young men. Funeral homes have at times run out of space to store and prepare bodies for burial. Zohair Hertelli, a Paris funeral director, told the AP this summer he's had to gently inform grieving families there was no room for their loved ones. Families are suffering, he said. We have no solution to offer them because the funeral homes are full. We are really facing a problem, a big problem. It's hard for me to hear those words and not think of funeral homes in war zones I have covered that have also been full. Scientists say the steady rise of heat caused by climate change may ignite more fires like the ones that swept France and Spain last month and those raging in the U.S., Canada, and across the world. The European Investment Bank and the European Commission released a study this summer that predicts farm losses in the EU will climb in the coming decades, with droughts, heat, and storms damaging crop yields and stressing animals. 2026 has been Europe's summer of heat, until perhaps next summer and summers to come. Americans, along with the rest of the world, know that feeling too. And you're listening to NPR News.
Hey, it's A. Martinez from NPR's Morning Edition, here to wish KAXE a happy 50th anniversary. As the first rural public radio station in the nation, KAXE has proven that world-class public media can grow from small towns and deep roots. KAXE reflects northern Minnesota with reporting on local government meetings, student nature observations, and programs such as Green Cheese Trivia, On the River, and Headwaters that provide a curated music soundtrack every day. NPR is honored to celebrate KAXE and 50 years of rural storytelling, trusted local and national news and music.
You can do your part and keep KAXE going strong into the future. Become a member. Text the word DONATE, 218-326-1234.
Nothing's really something, now the whole thing's good.
Minutes after 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Minnesota's primary election is coming up this Tuesday, August 11th. The KAXE news team has put together a primary election guide. Learn more about the candidates running to represent you at kaxe.org/election guide. New this year, printable versions. You can help by sharing election info with your friends and neighbors. You can join us this evening at the Green Cheese Picnic at KAXE's backyard in Grand Rapids. Bring a dish to share, your favorite beverage, and your own chair. The fun starts at 5 o'clock with live green cheese trivia from 7 to 9. You can bring your own trivia questions and answers too. And at the end of the evening, we'll crown a new king and queen of green cheese. We hope to see you there. Coming up at 9 o'clock, KAXE Rewind. Right now, more from Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Immigrant detention is approaching record high numbers, not seen since January of this year, and private prison companies that work with ICE are reaping profits. NPR immigration correspondent Vanessa Romo joins us. Vanessa, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
You listened in on the earnings report calls for two large private prison companies. What did you hear?
I listened to calls with CoreCivic and Geo Group. And first, they both noted that this period includes the partial government shutdown of DHS, during which time the number of detentions dropped. Obviously, that had an impact on both companies' bottom line. But despite that, they still reported impressive profits. Let's start with the Geo Group. Here's CEO George Zoli talking to investors.
Our better-than-expected performance reflects significant revenue growth from the contracts that we entered into throughout 2025.
Zoli said that thanks to those contracts, total revenues for the company are up 15% to more than $730 million over the same period last year.
Tell us about the other company you heard about, CoreCivic.
Patrick Swindle is CoreCivic's president and CEO. He said that the company's total revenue went up by just over 27% for a total of more than $680 million. He said that they were able to exceed expectations by lowering operating costs, meaning that the business of detaining people is becoming cheaper.
And the profits grow larger. Now, does all that revenue come from holding people in detention?
No. In fact, both companies are finding different ways to become a sort of one-stop shop for all things related to holding people in detention and even once they're out. So Geo Group noted that their ankle monitoring sales are up and will likely increase further now that TPS, that's temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants, has ended. And our member station WVXU in Ohio previously reported on seeing Haitian migrants fitted with ankle monitors as they left meetings with ICE officials. Geo Group also said that they drew more money from transportation and flight contracts with the government, which went up as more people are being deported. Meanwhile, CoreCivic said it benefited this quarter from its purchase of Clinical Solutions Pharmacy, which is a mail order medications company for correctional facilities. But actually, Swindle started off the call touting the recent sale of four of their facilities to DHS.
We estimate our net proceeds from these four sales to be approximately $1.6 billion. At an average price per bed of $307,000.
Plus, Swindle added, CoreCivic will continue to get paid for operating those detention centers. So even though those sales won't be reflected until next quarter, they are part of a larger strategy to meet President Trump's goal of having 100,000 people in detention at once. And during the call with Geo Group, Zoli said that they're in talks to do the same.
Now, Vanessa, NPR has reported that Geo Group has government ties that run deep. What are those connections?
Well, they start at the top of ICE. The acting director, David Venturella, is a former executive at Geo Group. But in a recent letter, he told lawmakers that he's divested his Geo Group stock. Then there's Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, who was also a paid consultant for GEO Group before joining the government. And former Attorney General Pam Bondi also lobbied for GEO Group before she was appointed. Then there's the president's ties to both GEO Group and CoreCivic. There was an analysis of Trump's most recent financial disclosures by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington last month. And they found that the president's brokers have made 29 trades of private prison stocks since he returned to office.
And Vera's Vanessa Romo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Child care costs are soaring across the country in places where the cost of living is high, like Oregon, and in more affordable places like Oklahoma, where state data shows the cost of infant care has gone up more than a third since 2022. As State Impact Oklahoma's Beth Wallace reports, that cost is putting working parents in a tight spot.
Brown bear, what do you see? I see a
spooky red buddy.
In Bethany, Oklahoma, Jennifer Williams reads and plays with her sons, Skylar and SJ. Skylar is 2, SJ is 4.
What is it?
House.
A house.
She says she thought she'd be a full-time working mom, but then Skylar came along well before SJ was old enough for public pre-K, and she and her husband couldn't afford to send 2 kids to daycare at once. So Williams left her school counseling job to stay home. She works a couple days a week at a child care program. She says it was a difficult call to make, but it was the right one for her family.
I guess now I can't imagine anything different, but it is hard to know that the choice is kind of made for me because of finances.
Oklahoma is the 4th most affordable state to live in, according to U.S. News and World Report. But the cost of child care, and especially infant care, which is more expensive, have skyrocketed. And Oklahoma's not alone. From 2022 to 2025, the national average price of child care shot up more than 20%. Infant care saw similar increases. That's according to Child Care Aware of America, a nonprofit advocacy network. In Louisiana, the next most affordable state to live in, infant care increased by 30%. In Washington, one of the least affordable states, infant costs soared by 41%.
We saw a big jump in child care prices a couple years ago.
That's Ann Hedgepeth, former Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at Child Care Aware of America. She says there's no single reason prices have gone up, but one factor was states delaying market rate surveys during the pandemic.
Those surveys are conducted on a fairly regular basis by state lead child care agencies, and they do go in to setting the subsidy rates.
States often subsidize child care for low-income families by sending money directly to providers. The size of that subsidy can make a big difference for providers' balance sheets. Over the past few years, as inflation drove up prices, some states didn't increase their payments to match. To fill in the gaps, families had to shell out more money, and child care providers had to make cuts.
Providing high-quality child care is expensive.
Rachel Proper is the president of Child Care Incorporated. It's a network of 7 child care centers in Oklahoma that serve mostly low-income families.
We really try to cater to that group of parents, and we try to do a good job and provide them high-quality care to the kids that we feel need it the most.
They currently charge an average of $975 a month per child before any subsidies. Proper's daycares got a boost from the state during the pandemic, but that boost ended. At the same time, her daycares were paying more for things like insurance and lunches. She says her centers have seen an 18% drop in their bottom line. To make the numbers work, they've cut employee benefits, trimmed back on business hours, and even stopped providing baby wipes.
We had to cut quality measures and really kind of get down to doing basic child care as opposed to really doing those things that are exceptional and bring magic to our classrooms.
These challenges come as the Trump administration has rolled back a Biden-era policy that aimed to cap how much low-income families had to pay for daycare. In the meantime, states are experimenting with their own fixes. North Carolina and Michigan have implemented a model where the state, employers, and families all share the cost of childcare. Oklahoma recently started a pilot program to expand access to subsidies for daycare employees. But New Mexico is the only state so far to offer free childcare to everyone. For NPR News, I'm Beth Wallace in Tulsa.
What goes up must come down. Well, not if you're talking about space junk. Old satellites, rocket stages, and other smaller bits of missions gone by are still in orbit.
So right now we currently track about 54,000 objects that are greater than about a softball size.
Now, an old piece of booster rocket isn't likely to crash into your living room anytime soon, but we are shooting things into space at a record clip, and soon, too much space junk could affect our daily lives in a big way.
We're not going to go back to the Stone Age, but we'll probably go back to the 50s.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha, the growing problem of space junk. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. The Edinburgh Fringe Festival begins this weekend, of course, in Scotland, and this year's program features more than 3,500 shows, comedy, dance, drag, circus, cabaret, and more for around 50,000 performances over the next 3 weeks. How do critics begin to cover it? We welcome Kate Kopstick, who's been a comedy critic for the local newspaper, The Scotsman, for more than 25 years. She joins us from Edinburgh. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It gets me off the streets, Scott.
Well, good. Glad we could be a part of that. How do you decide what to see, what to review?
Well, as soon as the Fringe brochure, which this year is the size of a house brick, comes out, what I do is I just go through it all. You make a first pass and you kind of tick off things that sound interesting on the basis, and call me judgmental, but I am a critic, that if a performer can't write a 50-word bit of blurb to entice you to see his or her or their show, then they're not really that much more likely to be able to write a good show.
You see, I'm told, 3 or 4 performances daily?
Yes, about 4, because I do think it is only fair to see as many as possible. And I personally try to see as many shows in free venues, in pay-what-you-want venues, performers who are really treating this like a fringe and not an industry showcase.
Of course, I have to ask. So many names became famed coming out of the Edinburgh Festival. I mean, in no particular order, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Robin Williams, John Cleese, Stephen Fry, Rowan Atkinson. Who or what do you remember seeing that especially stays with you over the years?
Probably I'm not the best person to ask, because the shows I remember are not necessarily performers who ended up with massive television acclaim. I mean, I love shows by comics who are unapologetically themselves. And that's becoming harder and harder to find, because so many comics come here to become famous. There used to be a truism that was, you came to Edinburgh to get drunk, to get laid, and to get famous. And now...
Oh, my.
And if you could manage all three, then you were on a winner.
Over the years, has Edinburgh gone from being a fringe festival to a launching pad?
It's worse than that. So much worse than that, Scott. It's gone from a fringe festival through a launching pad to it's just an industry fair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it started, the big thing they went on about was open access. And now the sheer cost involved It is frightening. And the only places that are still truly old school fringe are the free fringes and the free festivals.
What are you going to see this weekend, do you think? Can you tell us?
Well, I've just seen a comic called Simon Munnery. Genius. Extremely strange, but genius. And because I don't go to any of the expensive shows, I don't see any of the big names. And I'm very happy that way. But I think that no one that the wider world would have heard of, but maybe by the time I've seen them, been wildly impressed and written a glowing, many-starred review, the wider world will hear about them.
Kate Kopstick, comedy critic for The Scotsman. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In Spokane, at least 60,000 people have been evacuated as several fires continue to threaten homes. But animals have also had to leave, including some of the many horses that live on the rural-urban border of the city. Northwest Public Broadcasting senior correspondent Anna King went out to hear how they were doing.
Bubbles is a handsome, tall, black-brown horse. And as you can hear, he's upset. Horses often talk to each other when they're distressed or confused. Bubbles has been a bit off his feed and water since he and his owners were evacuated from the Autumn Lane fire in the north part of Spokane. He's not used to being stalled. Here at the Spokane County Fair and Expo Center, dozens of horses, a donkey, and even an emu are taking reprieve from the fire. Nearby, there's a whole other building for dogs and other smaller animals.
I definitely knew that Bubbles would get on a trailer, no problem. He's a good boy.
That's Lou Hill. She's 46. She lives in West Spokane and works for a nonprofit in town. She boards Bubbles and her other horse up north where there are many boarding and training facilities, right where several fires burned through. Hill says she had to trust that the ranch owners would get her horses trailered out. In emergencies, people write phone numbers on horses' coats in case the horses get lost or separated from their owners. Horses don't have dog tags.
The idea of letting my horse go and then hoping that I find them again is probably the most devastating feeling you can imagine.
She says she has a close relationship with her horses.
You can feel that they're scared too, and they know something's coming. They have just as much urgency to be safe.
The people here are stressed too. Many of them have had to evacuate their homes and don't know when they'll return. Several were helping to clean stalls. 12-year-old Justin sweeps up an empty stall. His mom is a volunteer here. He has a toothy grin and a curly blonde mop of hair. His grandmother and grandfather's home burned up in the old trails fire. And Justin's mother asked that we not use his last name because the family fears looters might target their destroyed property.
By the time they got the level 3 evacuation, ashes were falling on their car. So luckily they got both their cars and everything important and they got out safely.
His own family had to evacuate the Fairview fire. He managed to save his baseball, football, and basketball cards.
Yeah, it was pretty scary.
What do you remember about all that when, like, you had to leave? What'd your mama say?
She just said, pack whatever you could, what's important to you, stuff that can't be replaced. And so I just grabbed everything that was important. And within 15 minutes, a police showed up and said, you gotta go. So we left.
Justin is sad and a bit stressed, just like pretty much everyone around him. But many say working with the livestock, cleaning stalls, and filling water buckets makes them feel like they can do something. It helps. For NPR News, I'm Anna King in Spokane, Washington.
And this is NPR News.
It's 7:39. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help, 211, and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly brunch buffet tomorrow from 9 to noon at their community center located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. Celebrate the garden harvest with a variety of breakfast and lunch items. And Brainerd Night Out is Tuesday, August 11th, 5 to 7 at Gregory Park. Enjoy free hot dogs, games, and music, plus meet area law enforcement and neighbors. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Todd Blanche has narrowly won Senate confirmation to lead the Justice Department. In an all-night session, all Democrats voted against his nomination. They were joined by two Republicans. Blanche previously served as President Trump's personal attorney and acting attorney general. Water rationing is underway in Puerto Rico as a severe drought drains reservoirs across the island. More than 180,000 customers are facing 48-hour water shutoffs on a rotating schedule. Wildfires are now burning across Serbia following weeks of destructive fires in France and Spain. One blaze is threatening a nature reserve about 40 miles from Belgrade. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from Legacy Box, dedicated to preserving family stories by converting home movies, film, and slides into digital files to revisit and share for generations to come. More at LegacyBox.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Coming up on NPR, Lewis Kalb.
That's Lewis Kalb of Medford Lakes, New Jersey.
I'm known as the voice of Medford Lakes because every event in town I'm at, announcing it.
Kalb, who is 73, is a substitute teacher and volunteer broadcaster of pretty much anything.
Whether it be rec basketball, middle school basketball, the canoe carnival, the 5K runs.
And now I can add Major League Baseball to that list. The longtime Philadelphia Phillies fan placed a bid to win the opportunity of a lifetime to do the play-by-play of the third inning of the Phillies game against the Washington Nationals Wednesday for 94 WIP Radio.
So here we go. Painter with the first pitch to Ortiz. It's in there for strike one call. Phils with two in the bottom of the second to take the lead.
And, well, you can hear he did great.
As we start the top of the third now, Painter delivers. It's bounced foul.
When you have something that's a lifelong George dream and you get one shot at it, one inning, really, make the best of it.
Kalb says he's been preparing for the chance for years by essentially calling an imaginary game as he drove his car.
Some people like to sing in the shower. Well, I don't have a good singing voice, but I might drive down the road and go, here is Bryce Harper. And the pitch swung on. Long drive to right. That one is gone.
Kalb got to call one Bryce Harper at bat on Wednesday night. And a single, sadly. No runs in the third inning.
And I like the way the inning concluded because it was with a strikeout. And I said something like, got him, strike three, and that's it. The inning is over. And so, you know, we got to the break and it went pretty well.
Well, more for Lewis Kalb than the Phillies, who didn't fare well and lost to the Nationals 10-4. Kalb has gotten a lot of acclaim on social media, but says his head will not be turned to larger markets.
All of this fame and publicity, anybody would appreciate it. But what I love most about it is when I go do a game now, that's going to be Mr. Kalb, the Phillies announcer in the broadcast booth, who's doing my game. It's just going to have more meaning. It's going to be more special for all the great kids in our wonderful town.
Mr. Lewis Kalb, the voice of Medford Lakes, New Jersey, and, you know, once a big league broadcaster. Ed Saxberger sorts mail at a New York post office and trudges between work, his apartment, and a bar where everybody knows his name without drawing much notice. Till one night, a young man waits for him.
You're Ed Saxberger.
What is this about?
My name is Wilson Myers. Myers, everyone calls me.
Okay.
Stopped writing poetry?
Years ago. I worked at the post office for years now. So?
A man of letters.
I guess you could say that.
Late Fame is a new film starring Willem Dafoe as the poet, who may have been overlooked by time, Greta Lee and Edmund Donovan. It's directed by Kent Jones, and Willem Dafoe joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Help us understand Ed Saxberger. He's not unhappy when we meet him, but what does it do to have a young person track him down about poems he wrote back in the day?
Yeah, I think that's a part of his life that he's left behind. Things change. People change. Cities change. And when he was young, he was a particular person that pursued this love for poetry. And then I think he found it difficult to sustain himself. And he took a job in the post office and then kind of recalibrated his life socially and all that. And this young poet invites him to hang out with a group of poets that admire him a great deal. And he slowly gets seduced and flattered into hanging out with them and kind of enjoys their energy and their ambitions. And he starts to reconsider going back to writing poetry again.
Yeah. And tell us about this group that call themselves the Enthusiasm Society.
Yes, and they're a bunch of well-educated young men, and they also have one female participant who's not really an official member, but she's hanging out, and she's an actress. That's played by Greta Lee. She's kind of important in the story because she is not exactly like them. She's an actress that is having a hard time sustaining herself and is at that point where she has to figure out what to do, and she pushes and pushes and pushes and has a different strategy than Ed did. The boys are all ambitious. They have a great nostalgia for another time, for a kind of classicism. They poo-poo the people around them that are on their devices all the time, and they embrace Ed and say he's their North Star.
The story is adapted from an unpublished 1895 novella by Arthur Schnitzler.
Yes, and a friend of mine, a New York writer and performer by the name of Danny Zippy, gave me this novella and said, you should see this. I think this is a movie for you. And I read it, and I liked it very much, and I was kind of toying with the idea of reaching out to see who had the rights. Little did I know there was already a script in Killer Films. I was planning to make this film with Kent Jones. And then the really kinky part is I ran into Kent Jones, who I know basically through the New York Film Festival. And we sat next to each other and we talked the whole flight, catching up on things. But we never talked about Schnitzler or this novella. Mm. And then 2 days later, he calls me up and asks me to do the role. I think it's called Kismet.
I'm flabbergasted by that. You came to New York yourself in the 70s, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I did. And so I had skin in this game a little bit because there was a lot I related to, even though it's not my story. We're imagining and hearkening back to that time. So it was personal.
Was it a place, as Saxberger recalls, like living on the moon, everyone was young, an artist, and poor?
A little bit. I'm very careful because I don't want to get too nostalgic about that time. But the truth is, you know, I was a middle-class kid from the Midwest, and I came to New York to have an adventure. I wasn't interested in career. I wasn't interested in fame because the truth is that what I was interested in didn't have a career path. I was working in kind of avant-garde theater, but around me was a lot of energy and a lot of people like me who weren't trained in performing arts or in visual arts, but they were doing it.
What's it like for Sachsberger to pick up the pen again?
Probably torturous, because he's out of practice and he's not connected to it. He doesn't have the same kind of support. And, you know, it's a horrible thing for these people to tell you that, yeah, it's flattering, but it's a horrible thing. You know, flattery can ruin you. Flattery can make you believe you are who other people say you are rather than who you are. He's just out of practice. He's out of touch with putting these feelings onto paper and playing with words or whatever poetry is. And I think he doesn't know whether it's a natural evolution that he's gone away from it or whether it's a kind of surrender to a different life.
Gloria exclaims to Ed Sachsberger at one point, "I'm an artist and I belong to no one, just my art." And I wonder, as an artist yourself, an actor, what do you think about that?
I try to leave myself out of it. What I do, obviously, it comes from myself because I use my body, I use my mind, I use my heart doing what I do. But I always feel like I'm most comfortable, and I've said this before, but it's really true, when I disappear into the action. So who I belong to, I don't care. What I belong to is to find my place in the order of things, and that's where real freedom is. And you can say that on a grand scale, but you can also say that in any context of a collaborative art form. You've got to find your place in that work, in that collaboration, and you've got to find the space where you can contribute something. And if you can do that without being totally egoistic or self-serving, it can be a real liberation.
May I ask, are there young aspiring actors who approach you and ask for advice?
Of course. I mean, I shouldn't say of course. But yes, in fact, in this movie, these young actors that are in the Enthusiasm Society are fantastic. They're really good. They were really well cast, and I really enjoyed working with them. And that's not just polite showbiz talk. I really like these guys. And they were sort of beginning, so we had this kind of meta thing going on, this mirror of, we shot in winter in New York City and partly in New Jersey, and it was cold, and this wasn't a big production, so we didn't have trailers, so we'd often have to huddle between takes, you know, in little holding areas, and so we were hanging out and eating together and all that sort of thing. And with time, after they got over initial nerves, they would start to ask me, "Oh, what was it like on this movie? What was so-and-so like? How do you do this?" You know? So they were kind of, it was kind of an echo of what was happening in the movie. It was pretty crazy, but I enjoyed it. And also, I felt the seduction of that kind of attention and that kind of need to hear and treat you like an elder, which, as I go about this, I think it's always useful to say that it's strange for me because I was always, in fact, I used this line.
This line's in the, yeah.
In the movie, I was always the youngest in every group. And then one day, all of a sudden, I looked around and I was the oldest one.
Willem Dafoe stars in the new film, Late Fame, in theaters now. And thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And the civil rights era on folk and rock music have been associated with social movements. Classical music, not so much. Cello superstar Yo-Yo Ma wants to change that at the Tanglewood Music Festival, and tonight he wraps up a week of performances and public conversations to reflect on the country's past and future. Karen Brown of New England Public Media checked out the event in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts.
When I first met Yo-Yo Ma, he was warm and self-deprecating. Here's how he introduced himself when we talked on the sprawling grounds of Tanglewood, the classical music venue in the Berkshires.
My name is Yo-Yo Ma. I'm an aging cellist.
Never mind, he's probably the world's best-known cellist, famous since he was 7 when he played for President John F. Kennedy. More recently, he founded the Silk Road Ensemble, a global musical collaboration. So when Yo-Yo Ma, now 70, takes on a project, people listen. For his latest, based at Tanglewood, Ma curated a week of concerts, public conversations, and community events to reflect on the American experiment. It's called We the People.
Obviously, we're going through the 250th celebration, but also at a time when I think, in many ways, we the people, we the species, are at an inflection point. Where are we going?
Hopefully, he says, somewhere that celebrates diverse voices, including immigrants, indigenous people, and youth. Throughout the week, Ma weaved his own performances with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, together with high school marching bands and Native American storytellers. He booked a Latino block party in the theater pavilion and a square dance on the lawn.
Make an arch, couple number one, you make an arch, couple number two.
One evening, he introduced a student performance of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, played without a conductor.
Their experiment is to agree on how to play and feel together without a single leader, an example of musical democracy.
When putting together the program, Ma says he looked for collaborators with a hopeful message, using the lens of a grandfather.
You can't be cynical with your grandchildren. You have to have hope. You know, my youngest granddaughter is 2 years old. Who can actually help us think about a world she would want to live in?
His picks included folk singer James Taylor, political historian Heather Cox Richardson, and Alabama civil rights lawyer Brian Stevenson, who founded several memorials to the legacy of slavery.
I think music has always been an important part of the struggle to create a more just America. Without the spirituals, many of the 10 million black people who were enslaved in this country would not have been able to cope with the constant terror, violence, and assault.
But over the past century of injustices, Stevenson says many musicians, especially in classical music, have looked the other way.
Yo-Yo Ma stands, I think, on the opposite side of that tradition. He is a musician that refuses to be silent in the face of the kind of horrors we've seen throughout history. And I think that's an important model for other musicians and for other artists and people who love music and art.
Composer Allison Loggins Hull, whose work was performed at the event, says she's grateful classical music institutions like Tanglewood are starting to take that kind of risk.
I can say that there has been a significant change, much more willingness to have these type of discussions that maybe aren't directly about music or the tradition, but more about the responsibility of just being a citizen.
Ma insists that We the People is not political, and neither is he. Diversity, he says, speaks for itself.
So it's not like I don't have a political agenda. I'm actually for the good of people. And instead of protesting, I just like to join things together. And, you know, why shouldn't we be one community?
The next day, he put on sneakers and a polo shirt to play cello on the street as part of a local busking festival. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Western Massachusetts.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. And from DuckDuckGo, a private search engine and browser. DuckDuckGo believes AI should be optional and private. Now with duck.ai, users can chat privately with AI. Learn more at duck.ai.
It's just before 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Since 1976, Northern Community Radio has been telling the stories of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. Keep KAXE people powered into the future with your support now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition. 9 o'clock KAXE Rewind to listen back to some of the conversations you may have missed this week. And 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Weather for today, sunny, highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s, west winds 5 to 10, gusting higher. Lows tonight in the low 50s to low 60s with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 76 to 82. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny and highs in the upper 70s. More news is next.